9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Hey, this is Jason Gay speaking to you from a remote location. And we're talking art today on the Free For All, specifically Larry Gagosian, who you may or may not know is one of the most important people in the world of fine art. We'll talk to Elisa Lipsky-Karras of the Wall Street Journal magazine, who's written a terrific cover story about him.
This is Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, from New York, here's Jason Gay.
This is Jason Gay talking to you remotely, literally from the stairwell of my apartment complex in Brooklyn, New York, because my children are asleep. I'm vaguely under the weather. I hope I don't sound vaguely under the weather. I had a late night, thanks to my next guest magazine, I had a late night where I arrived at LaGuardia Airport after midnight, for which I believe I'm due some combat pay. If you have to land at LaGuardia Airport after midnight on a weekday, on any day really, you should get time and a half. I want to ask my next guest about that, though. That Elisa Lipsky-Karras is with us. She is the deputy editor of Wall Street Journal, WSJ Magazine. And you know why I was out last night late.
Yes.
And so I'm blaming it on you.
No, I had nothing to do with it. Sorry about that. You can blame the rest of the team.
I was on a top secret assignment, top secret for WSJ Magazine. And it was a lot of fun, but it was a long day. And I think I'm paying the price right now for those airport hot dogs that
I
had. Yeah,
LaGuardia after dark doesn't sound like a good place to be.
No. But the reason you are here in the WSJ pod, and you sound terrific because you're in the actual radio studio today, is that you have the cover story for this month's WSJ Magazine. This is not your first cover story, I believe, is it?
No, it's not. I've done a couple before.
Okay, who'd you do before this one?
I've done Julia Roberts and...
Never heard of her. Well, is she an actor?
Yes, just a small-time actress, just breaking into the business.
Yeah.
And then actually, the other one was a more emerging actress, Cara Delevingne.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Cara. Also a supermodel of the moment.
Yes.
I know my cultural figures, Elisa. But your cover story this week, or this month rather, is about a very, 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 very important person in the art world who, you know, the average person on the street may not know too much about. They might recognize the name because his name's around, especially here in New York. But he's an influential person, and this is an incredibly well-reported look at his life and his impact. And his name is Larry Gagosian. He is an art dealer, unabashedly refers to himself as an art dealer, and is sort of just, you know, this incredible one-man force in the world of art. And for the person who might not be terribly familiar with Larry and what his impact is, what's sort of the elevator pitch for why Larry Gagosian is such an important person and deserving of a cover in a magazine?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for saying it was well reported. I take that as a high compliment coming from you.
First of all, you're an excellent reporter, but secondly, it's sort of testament to this guy's clout because it practically read like the Forbes 400, the people you got on this on the record to talk about Larry. It was amazing.
Yeah, I have a lot of yacht phone numbers now.
I imagine this story will be on the coffee tables of many yachts this month.
Well, yeah, and actually, I'm sure the art that he sold some of these figures is there as well.
Sure.
Well, basically, Larry Gagosian has 16, just opened his 16th gallery worldwide. The next closest gallery owner, I think, has 10 locations. So you can see already there's a huge jump in terms of coverage. He's really considered to be in his own ecosystem by the rest of the art world.
Yeah.
He clears about $1 billion of art annually through his galleries. And, of course, they don't divulge numbers publicly, but that's by people who track these things. That's the estimate. And he also deals in many, he's a multifaceted art dealer. And again, as you pointed out, he calls himself a dealer, not a gallerist. He specializes in contemporary market sales, i.e. working with living artists, and many of his artists are legendary figures, like Richard Serra, Jeff Koons. The list is very long if you go onto his website.
Yes. John Curran is somebody who obviously has risen to prominence during the time he's been with Larry.
Yes. So, but he also does what are called secondary market deals, which are these private deals whereby art that has previously been sold then changes hands. And, of course, this is where a lot of times the numbers skyrocket into sort of unfathomable figures. It sort of almost feels like monopoly money.
Yes.
And he has been able to really create a sort of very liquid market for what are usually things that people hold on to for decades, if not entire lifetimes, and then donate to museums.
But why would you go to Larry instead of, you know, one of the more traditional houses like a Christie's or Sotheby's or Phillips? What's the impetus of going to Larry? Is it just that Rolodex of people he has, those people who would buy?
I think, first of all, Larry can find things. I mean, if you're going to Christie's or to Sotheby's, you're waiting for something to come up for auction, which can take a long, long time.
Sure.
Also, there is no privacy. Those numbers are public.
Yes.
So if you're, a very wealthy person who likes to keep their, activities private, you would not find that that was the case at an auction house. Of course, people do work through intermediaries, but there's still a public element to it. So if you work with Larry, you're insured usually a, high degree of privacy. And also he's able to find things for people, and everyone has agreed that it's at a level that's never been seen before. If you say, that you want this Picasso or that Cy Twombly or whatever, he's really able to track things globally and find them, things that are extremely rare, and create deals often where things were not even considered to be for sale by their owners. So a famous public case of that is when David Geffen sold Woman 3 by de Kooning to hedge funder Steve Cohen for $140 million. Essentially $140 million. And that was a situation where he called up Geffen and convinced him to sell the painting.
Okay. And so the hypothetical here is that, I'm a very wealthy person, and I am interested in either adding to a collection or growing a collection I want to get a Picasso or de Kooning or Jasper Johns, whatever. Larry is the person who can go out and get me one, find me one, and connect me with the right people.
Yeah, and he also, Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone compared him to a block trader. He takes on the risk himself. He has a high appetite for risk, these are not, cheap things that he's acquiring. So he will often purchase the piece himself and then turn around and sell it to someone else. And he's been able to do that, many, many times.
So he's not simply serving as an intermediary. He's not somebody who's just connecting buyer to seller.
No. He really, he's placed himself, some people said to me, he's almost like too big to fail at this point, comparing him to that, the levels that we're talking about. Obviously, this is not a regulated market. So he doesn't have to deal with the same obstacles that are present in some other markets, perhaps. But he has placed himself at this very singular nexus point between, he controls, obviously, access to a lot of the greatest living artists. He also, is on, he texts and calls, he's on very familiar basis with really the top collectors.
Doesn't use email, doesn't like computers.
No. Well, he's an old-fashioned guy. He doesn't have a computer on his desk. He doesn't own a computer.
I love what he said. Yeah. He said, if you have a computer, you spend long enough on it, pretty soon you're ordering a cashmere hoodie. That says it all.
Exactly. He doesn't want you to dilute your assets like that.
I'm curious about, a person like this. One of the things that comes across in the story very clearly is that, he's not a guy who, though he lives in this rarefied world, of private jets and all that, he doesn't like pretentiousness. He doesn't seek to be a pretentious guy. And you know, in addition to being unabashed about calling himself a dealer, he says, like, look, you know, like, there's no reason to, like, deny the certain elitism of art. You know, it's not for everybody. It's like, you know, I think he refers to it sort of, or compares it to poetry, and says that, you know, where this doesn't have to be for everybody. You, not everybody's going to be able to swim in this world. And there's no shame in that. Do you think that's a fair representation?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think, listen, he's the ultimate American rags to riches story, you know,
yes.
And he himself was not educated in the traditional, you know, academic cloistered world that many, you know, people who end up in the art world have gone through. So he himself comes from a very sort of different place, and he still to this day, even though he is at sort of the top of the heap of the art world, considers himself an outsider.
Yeah.
You know, he's actually not permitted to show at the Armory show because he's not a member of the Art Association. You know, he's never been accepted.
Does he like that? I mean, does he yearn for the acceptance, or is he sort of
like the
rogue image a little
bit?
No,
he says, you know, I'm not a club guy. That's what he says about it. He really just wants to do his own thing. And I think he's a real straight talker. And that's why these guys, you know, a lot of his clients are, as you pointed out, sort of like the top, you know, the Forbes list. They're guys who do deals all day long, and they want to be able to do deals with somebody who they can see eye to eye with. You know, everybody from François Pinault to Schwartzman, to, you know, even Leon Black, you know, said that he has this amazing talent for business. He almost could have been a CEO had he come across some other, you know, thing. As it was, he was a parking attendant when he realized he might make a couple bucks selling some posters.
And
then when
he was
there.
I think he says in your story he was selling schlock.
Pictures
schlock.
Of girls and you know, ocean vistas. And then but he had the other thing that every single person is, you know, many of the people I interviewed about this said about him was that he has an uncanny eye, and they used exactly those terms, which I thought was very interesting. He really does have sort of a natural eye for art, and what will make, you know, what will make it something that he can sell.
Yeah. I imagine that one thing that's tricky when you're writing about a world like this is, as you said, you know, the dollars can be somewhat nebulous because, you know, these aren't public companies and they're not sort of putting all those numbers out there. But at the same time, it's a little bit hard to grasp what intent is oftentimes in the art market. And you hear every so often that, you know, one of the things that's happened in the art world as, you know, economies everywhere grow more and more volatile, that art's a pretty good place to perhaps have your money. And that's, you know, increased demand. And, you know, with the increase in demand, of course, set the prices skyrocketing. Do you think that that has made somebody like Larry even more powerful? The fact that, you know, art has become in the, you know, oligarch and CEO community such a wise buy?
Well, I think you do have to be very knowledgeable. I mean, Larry himself will say, I'm not selling investments. He makes no, you know, predictions about what will happen. As he says, that's why we call it the test of time.
Yes.
So, but he has, you know, as somebody told me, you know, he's really been around for what has been a massive shift. And as somebody said, it was the right place, right time, right execution by him. So he has been able to sort of harness this energy and indeed, I would say, contribute to it greatly, of this shift in the market where, you know, art has become an asset class. At the same time, as he pointed out, it's not for everybody. You have to have a great deal of knowledge, be able to sort of assess things within a context. And with it, if it's contemporary art, there isn't always a context because it's being created right now. So that's up to you. But, you know, I think that these are often things that people do hold on to for a long time. And if you make the right judgment, it can turn into an investment. On the other hand, you know, it could be the wrong call. It might be something that you simply respond to emotionally. And as he said, he's, you know, it's not like dealing with any other luxury good. He can't just call up the artist and say, hey, we want to order 10 more of these from the factory. So, and in fact, one of the things I thought was most interesting about him is he's not a gallerist who sort of works with the artists on their art. He leaves them alone to work in their studio, and when they're done, he wants it all, and he'll sell it for them, as long as they're happily producing. So he really doesn't like to interfere or get involved in that way, whereas there are other gallerists who do work very closely with their artists. So I think the artists that thrive with him are the ones who are very, you know, self-motivated, driven, ambitious, and often up to creating these sort of very large pieces that live well in his galleries.
At the same time that, you know, there are several artists in the story who speak to what they, I wouldn't say pressure, but, you know, there's a feeling of wanting to raise your game if you're showing with Larry, that, you know, he's somebody who has pioneered these large spaces and this kind of, you know, show craft for his gallery spaces that, you know, you want to go big, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly he's been able to sort of accommodate those ambitions. I think, you know, he's very proud of his spaces. The other, you know, he doesn't cut corners in terms of his galleries or the means with which he tries to support his artist. Yeah. You know, there are people who are of two minds of that. There have been articles written saying that this is pushing art in a direction that it shouldn't. But Larry's take on it is, hey, my artists want to be able to do these things, and I'd like to help them achieve it.
Yeah. The people that are in this story, and it really is, it's like a cannonball run of the powerful in the world, from David Geffen to Jeff Koons, I believe, is in the story. Who was the hardest to get on the phone?
It was all juggling and scheduling. Let's see. I think I had to. A lot of them don't use email, by the way. So that was probably the most challenging.
These are old school people in this story.
These are old school phone guys, including the artists. I think Jeff actually was funny. I was talking to him, and he was like, actually, I'm in a car in Qatar right now. Could we reschedule for when I'm back in New York? And so, and I myself was traveling between Milan and Paris and New York for the fashion shows. So, you know, it was one of the only times I think I had to tell someone like Steve Cohen, actually, I'm not available for you. actually, I think it speaks to, you know, people are very interested in Larry and they want to be able to talk about him, actually. Yeah. At times I thought I was almost running sort of a group therapy session.
He becomes an important figure in these people's lives.
They want to weigh in. Yeah, they wanted to weigh in. So actually, strangely, it was bizarrely easy to get most of them on the phone, actually. I think I spoke to Eli Brode when he was actually staying at Larry's house in St. Bart's. So it was interesting to get a peek into this world.
How were your expenses for the story?
Oh, very low.
Good.
Very low.
You didn't buy any art?
No, I didn't buy any art.
I would have bought it to Kooning and said it was a hat. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Like,
actually, one of the things I think to go back to your first question about what makes Larry so compelling as a figure is that he has been able to straddle all parts of the market, including things that someone like me could buy, because he has a retail store as well, where he sells things like branded candles and, dishware, and even online you can buy sort of Damien Hirst deck chairs.
Yes.
So, and a lot of the artists seem to like to do skateboards, surfboards, and he's been able to do that without sort of cannibalizing the high quality of what's shown in the art gallery. So it's very interesting. He also does historical shows that compete with the museums. I spoke to every head of the museums in New York and LA, and they all feel like they now are paying attention to, even, you know, Sir Nicholas Sirota at the Tate said, you know, back when he saw the very first sort of show that the pop art show and the de Kooning shows that Larry did in Chelsea when he was the first gallery to open in Chelsea, that these were shows that as museum directors they needed to pay attention to. So he's been able to sort of straddle everything. We could walk in and see a free show at his galleries that you would have to pay to see in a museum. We could buy a poster. You could buy a book. He has a publishing branch. Perhaps Mr. Murdoch should watch out. They publish 40 books a year. They have an in-house magazine, a newspaper, as well, and they travel to all the global art fairs. So it's an incredible organization that's sort of constantly juggling, and he's constantly expanding. So he's showing no sign of slowing down.
And actually, a little bit of news has occurred in his life relatively recently, which is that Hearst is back in the fold.
Yes, Damien Hearst. Well, you know, it's funny, when I was starting, I can't remember if it was a story, another story I was reporting, but someone said to me, you know, Larry Gagosian's the only person who could bring back Damien Hearst, because obviously Damien Hearst is one of these examples of an artist whose, you know, place in the canon and value has ricocheted a little bit. And he famously, you know, auctioned a lot of his own work himself, which kind of rocked the value of his work a little bit. And as well, I think, dinged it in the mind of the sort of more academic people in the world. And now he's, you know, he was without, he left Gagosian for several years, and now he's come back to him. So I think that will be very interesting to follow what happens with his, you know, place in the pantheon now.
Elisa, this is great. I want to put you on hold for 5 seconds so we can check with our wonderful sponsors here at the Free For All, and we'll be right back with Elisa Lipsky Cares.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigna. If you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast, you are going to feel worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
This is Jason Gay back here on the Free For All, and we are doing this remotely as I am under the weather. But not under the weather, and in the studio is Elisa Lipsky Karras, who is the deputy editor of WSJ Magazine. How is that job, by the way? You like it?
Yeah, it's not bad.
No complaints?
No complaints. I do.
You got to have a couple complaints. You can tell me. No one listens.
I don't know. Let's see.
How long have you been there?
I've been here for 3 years.
3 years.
I came with our when our new editor in chief started, Christina.
We had regime change. You were
regime
part of
change,
the new regime.
Exactly. So I do.
And you guys
are a
lean and mean machine, but you know, it sounds like you have a lot of fun all the time over there.
Yeah, yeah. We're 12 times a year, and we have about half the staff of most monthly magazines, but that's fine.
Yeah. But in some ways, that probably makes it a little bit of fun, you know, that there's not a lot of, you know, people to sift through.
No,
you all
know
each other.
We work very collaboratively, and we get to work with writers like you. So,
well,
happy about
that's a drawback. Well, I want to ask you a couple more questions about Larry, but I want to ask you a little bit more about your job. Now, are you an art person? Are you somebody who has an art background at all? Was this a completely foreign world for you?
Yes and no. I majored in comparative literature, so it's not exactly. But I would always describe myself as an art fan. I took a fair amount of art history classes, which is obviously a bit of a different subject than.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Princeton, where I was.
Where's that?
It's in New Jersey.
Is it a commuter school?
Yes, almost. But yeah, you can take New Jersey Transit there pretty easily.
Okay, so it's an internet night school.
Yes. So, I got my correspondent.
Did you have Joyce Carol Oates? Was she one of your professors?
She was not. She was focused on the creative writing, which was an English.
That's right.
An English degree, creative writing.
But you have a lot. There are a lot of famous.
If you want to talk about Derrida and Barthes and deconstruct some text, I'm your girl.
Believe me, I don't even know what any of that is, but it sounds great.
So, but I was lucky enough. Princeton did have a wonderful sort of like somehow visiting professor. I don't know how they organized it, but I did have professors like Hal Foster, who was not a traditional professor. He had been at Art Forum, and so he introduced his class was what really introduced me to the contemporary art world.
And so how did you get into the glamour-soaked world of magazines in 2016?
Oh, through no fault of my own. I couldn't make up my mind of what I wanted to do for a job. Yep. And so I thought, oh, well, magazines cover a bit of everything, and I'll just make up my mind sometime
down
the line.
I, I'm exactly like you, and I think that newspapers and magazines are just full of thousands of people who just like couldn't figure out what they wanted to do, and they're like, yeah, this sounds pretty good for a few years.
Exactly.
And here we are.
And also didn't want to have to graduate because, you know, it's like we always have term papers due.
Okay. Well, I know there are a couple of quick Larry things we want to talk about before we have to go. One is that there's a really fun story in there about, you know, Larry angling to get Bob Dylan to do a show. You know, Bob Dylan, of course, known as the great American singer-songwriter, but also an artist. And tell me a little bit about Larry's work to get him up on the wall.
Well, he actually, Larry, is a huge Bob Dylan fan, has been to many, many, many concerts. And actually, he used to take along, like, John Elderfield, who's the former curator of paintings from MoMA, sort of very... you know, venerable type, and the two of them would go rock out at Bob Dylan concerts. So one day he was actually in the Hamptons, and he was walked into a small independent bookstore called Bookhampton and saw that there had been a book published by Bob Dylan of watercolors. So I think a little light bulb went off, and he thought, hey, maybe we could do a Bob Dylan show. So through some friends in the music world, he got connected to Jeff Rosen, who's Bob Dylan's longtime manager, and convinced him that he was a serious guy, not just some crazed fan, and managed to actually arrange for a meeting with Jeff and Bob to pitch the idea of doing a show, which Bob had never done. So, you know, he was directed to sort of walk behind, I think it was like through a boxing ring and then through a coffee shop, and the offices were very hidden. And then he walked into this room where he said it was full of, you know, brown shag carpeting, and there was some, you know, sort of receptionist. And then just at the back, there was Bob Dylan. And Larry, who never gets nervous, you know, dealing in hundreds of million dollars, was, I think, starstruck and a little nervous at the idea that he was going to pitch Bob Dylan. So, you know, he sat down, they started talking about it. You know, he said it was a bit awkward, and finally he just took a chance and cracked a joke, and then that sort of loosened up Bob Dylan, who said, hey, I like this Dylan Gagosian thing, let's do it. So
that's an excellent Dylan impression, Elisa, by the way.
Perfect. Oh yeah, exactly. That's
and he had to talk him into going.
He didn't want to show up, and Jeff was like, yeah, no, you know, Bob never does appearances. But basically Gagosian was like, fine, you know, I don't need to do this show, and you know, you sure as hell don't need to do this show, so let's forget it, because I'm not going to do it. You know, I need to do it right if I'm going to do it.
And then, but he also said it's going to sell for
He pointed out it would sell better. And he said at that point, you know, Dylan went, okay. So we came, and he said he wore some outfit that was like a cross between, I think, like Gandhi and Dylan or something, and like sat in the back. And then he had a party at his house. But most of the artists were, I think, equally starstruck, because they all mentioned getting to meet Bob Dylan as a high point, as Larry had a party at his house for him after. And then they went on, they did two shows, actually. So I think it was a success. But of course, you know, it was an outlier. I think, you know, people took it as a sign of, hey, Gagosian's like so commercial, he'll show this guy who has nothing to do with the art world. But I think Gagosian just felt, you know, this is the ultimate artist in his sphere. And he said Mick Jagger called him up and was like, would you, you know, he was talking to Mick about maybe Ronnie Wood, and he was like, no, I'm not doing Ronnie Wood, I'm not doing Joni Mitchell, you know, this is...
I'm not doing an Ariana Grande show.
Yeah, exactly.
There's another story that didn't make the final cut. It ended up on the cutting room floor, but in the director's cut of the story, it would appear, which is, can you just, we just have a couple minutes left, but that he accidentally purchased something very expensive for himself earlier in his career, Larry.
Yeah, well, one of the, you know, Larry rarely makes any mistakes. But anyway, he used to advise.
Same with me, by the way. I make any mistakes.
He used to, you know, he advises some of his clients by accompanying them to auction. So he was doing this very early in the days in the 80s when, you know, he really, you know, was just sort of more hand to mouth as a dealer, and you know, didn't have all these galleries. He went along with one of his most important clients to an auction, and the goal was to purchase a de Kooning piece, you know, at any cost to get this de Kooning piece, which they succeeded in. And as they were sitting there, Larry was flipping through the auction book and spotted a Philip Guston piece that he thought was amazing. So he said, "Hey, look at this. This is great." And the client said, "Oh, that's great. Buy it." Which, of course, Larry took to mean he should acquire it at any price for his client. So he proceeded to bid on it. They won it. And then they went out to dinner. And they ordered some drinks. And the client said to him, "Let's toast. Congratulations on your new painting." And Larry said he just went numb. He said he had no memory of anything. And he just thought, "Oh, my God. Now I have to pay Christie's. How am I going to play?" He's like, "How am I going to play Christie's?" Because at that time, he didn't have that kind of money. But eventually, he was able to unload the Philip Guston at a small profit.
I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. Well, most things have worked out for him. So
it's true. It's a great story. If you're a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal, it comes complimentary with your Saturday Wall Street Journal, which I hear from most people is their delightful weekend read always. And if you're not a subscriber, I would say WSJ Magazine is right there in the top list of reasons to subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. It is a peerless weekend magazine in the newspaper business and a lot of fun. And Elisa and Christina and Chris and Brecky and the whole gang over there never sleep trying to find you the best stories in the cultural universe.
Thank you.
Elisa, we should mention before we go that we're neighbors. You know, we live around the corner from each other.
Yeah, we should do some play dates.
We have small children. We should do some clay dates. What is your pizza parlor of choice? Where do you get your pizza?
Oh, Sal's.
Sal's.
I'm an old school New York slice kind of person.
Yeah, you don't do that fancy pants Lou Cali stuff.
No.
Yeah, That's for the tourists.
I do like it as well, but I like a slice.
All right. Well, you can get a slice at Sal's for considerably less than a de Kooning at Gagosian, but it's not a reason not to read Elisa's fantastic story in WSJ Magazine, available now wherever your fine Wall Street journals are sold. Thanks so much, Elisa.
Thank you.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.